Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the BristolCon Fringe reading series.
And hello, everybody. Welcome to another BristolCon Fringe reading. It's our last one for this year, but definitely not our last one because we have a packed program already sorted out for 2014. We'll be telling you more about that later. But in the meantime, we have two fabulous readers that we're going to have today. Later on, we shall be hearing from our very own Joanne Hall, chair of BristolCon, author of many, many fabulous fantasy novels, and all-round wonderful person. Not to mention, somebody is very good at going to fetch batteries for microphones when they run out. Yep, that will work very well on the CV. However, our first reading is going to be somebody else who's very well known here. He's the organiser of the Bristol Flash events for National Flash Fiction Day, and he's written all sorts of short and flash fiction. He's been published in New Scientist and Physics World, Lytro, Kazka Press, and numerous anthologies. And he's going to read some of his shorter stuff for us today. That will be Mr. Kevin Henney. The way we're going to structure this is that Kevin will read some of his short stuff, and then Jo will do her reading, and then Kevin will come back and do some more short stuff. And that means that you get an extra break for going to order more beer, which I'm sure will make the pub very happy. Alrighty, and without further ado from me, here is Kevin.
Right, thank you very much. Okay, so I'm going to do two before the show goes on, and one after. And I was kind of wondering, what was I going to read? And I thought, shall I do SF or fantasy? So I can do both. There will be fate, fatalism, time travel, romance, sex between different species. We've got it all. Okay, I'm going to start with something a little more, slightly somber. Remembrance of Things Past. This was published a couple of years ago in The Fabulist and featured as a podcast in Litro. It has been years since I made this journey. I am slower and more easily tired. My footfall is not as sure as it used to be, but nor is it as bitter, as sad, as resigned. Up the slope, near the edge of the rock, the crowd has gathered. They stand along the ridge, waiting without conversation, silhouetted against the late afternoon sky. Joining them. The ground is dusty, sandy with scraps of sun-browned grass, like the dunes before a beach. Taken 2 months before today, the now faded photo on my desk remembers our last family visit to the beach. Madeleine looking out from beneath the sunshade of her hand, her light smile overseeing the girls. Nell in her purple star sunglasses and pink flower hat, her mouth drawn in shadow, a preview of adolescence between the giggles and play. Where Nell's sandcastles are numerous, ordered and well-formed, Kathleen's are few and careless, squinting and sunburnt, her sunglasses and hat willfully thrown aside. She beams a big camera smile, all teeth and gaps. Perfect in so many ways, imperfect in so many others. The eyes are hidden. I imagine I remember their glint, their colour, but I check other photos to be sure. I recall the sound of sea, but can I recall the sounds of that shoreline, those waves, on that day? Voices are easier. I can recall the mutter of idle nothings and words of comfort, although the words themselves are gone. And where are the smells of sea, of sun cream, of Maddie's hair? Smells hide in memory, found only with a map that is also the key, that is also the trigger. Perfectly lost. Perfectly lost. I reach the top of the slope, catching my breath in the still air. No ocean, only scrubland, and rocks, and a road. The smell is of desert. The crowd is all gathered, all but one. Madeleine and the girls will be along soon. We will watch them pass, these different ages of me, compelled to migrate. We return to this past as our present is marked out by anniversaries, birthdays, and other remembrances. We will watch the accident and wonder the same things. Was it the fading light? Was Maddie tired after so long behind the wheel? Were the girls squabbling, distracting her? Was there something on the road? Or perhaps a fault with a car? Was there anything we had missed, something we could do to change the outcome? Anything to alter time and replace tomorrow? Across the crowd, we each wear age differently. The haggard and the kempt. The mawkish and the resolved. The resigned and the hopeful. Chasing possibility, three scan the road with binoculars, while three others pore over notebooks of lists, figures and calculations, each looking for the overlooked, each hoping for a contradiction to be confounded, to unravel, to reveal an alternative. But hope is not common among us. A few look only at the ground in front of them. Most gaze across the desert at the darkened foothills and fading mountains. I catch momentary glances and a few stares. I remember being those others, looking at this older self, noting the one in the crowd of selves, obviously older and frailer than the rest, none older. The last to join the crowd is walking up the slope. There are 30 years between us. His journey is the first I made to come to this rock, to watch the accident from afar instead of attempting intervention. He sees me. He pauses, fists clenched. I remember the resentment, the feeling of being boxed by fate, of wanting to lay blame at the feet of who I am now for what I had told him. Words of comfort, words of despair. He looks away and takes his place in the crowd. The car is seen before it is heard. Everything is heading towards that moment, the moment I've seen, heard, and felt so many times. I know how it plays out, how it feels. A figure is running towards the road. His is the first time I made the journey. The technology had worked, but not with the precision I had hoped for or relied upon. I was running to recover lost time, running to reach the road, to stop the car, to change everything. But I was not alone. There were others running towards the road. I heard them and turned, hesitating, shocked, unable to make sense of these apparitions of myself. I believed I had fooled causality. I had found a way to pass through the surface of the present into the past. But it was a sting. At the last moment, I look away to watch the faces of the crowd. Some look, others turn. Despair is written on the younger faces. The older ones cannot be read. The air carries and thins the cries of those running towards the road. We each remember the phone call. The interruption, before we were due to present our paper, pulled away from the conference and the weekend together that Maddie and the girls had been driving across states to reach. The hotel, the departure, the hospital, the identification. Moments blurred together in an instant that took forever. There is nothing to be done, nothing to be said. The crowd disperses. Some linger, some rush away. Out near the road they do the same. But one of them looks to the horizon rather than the ground or the wreckage. Singled out by the sunset, he catches sight of movement, of figures on a distant rocky edge. I will wait for him. What has happened has always happened, and always will have happened. Time is like a river, but frozen, not flowing. Eddies, pulls, and falls are fixed in place, timeless and immutable. Closed curves in time allow my presence here and now. Temporal entanglement demands it, but the logic of time loops is self-consistent and cannot be hacked. I will take all this to my grave. This knowledge, this technology, this curse of impotence and reliving. The lid will close and my work and all the sadness it brings will be gone. The only markers will be an early paper, unpresented, obscure, seemingly little more than speculation, and the curiosity of my cancer, a novelty and a puzzle, and eventually a memory for the doctors who gathered round and sampled and discussed. I turn. He's coming up the slope. I cannot remember exactly what was said, but it was words of comfort, words of despair. He walks to the edge just along from me. He looks at the wreckage in the road. He looks at me. He looks to me. Troubled, uncertain, desperate. He walks over. He wants to ask. He wants to plead. He needs to know. I take his arm. Whatever I say will be the right thing. It will have been the same thing. Nothing can be changed. Words of comfort. Words of despair. I know. It's okay. There's nothing you can do. This one's slightly more positive. The human race gets wiped out. But I've tossed in a little romance just to keep it, you know, going. This is quite a short one. Ashes to Ashes, Manana, Manana. It was published by Kazga Press a couple of months ago. A discreet click and the images and chaos disappear into darkness. Beth lowered the remote. It was a moment before Jay frowned at her across the sofa, as if the light of what Beth had done had been delayed, reluctant to reach his eyes. A moment before his, "Why did you do that?" cut through all the other questions, the fears that had flooded in to fill the silence. "Do you really want to spend the last few minutes of your life, the last few minutes of everything, watching TV?" Jay scrunched his mouth in a way Beth recognised. Oh, in a way that meant he knew she had a point, but he didn't know how to acknowledge it. "I always knew that, you know, I thought if something like this happened, we'd have more than a couple of minutes," Beth said, looking out at the sky, sharp and blue and as clear of clouds as it was a premonition. Nothing to justify or hint at the fate that would soon rain down. "I always thought the answer would be obvious," Jay said, staring at the floor. "To what?" "To the question of what I want to do at the end of the world. How would I want to spend the last few minutes?" "The answer from most adult males is probably still the same as any adolescence. An answer too obvious to even question." Or so I thought. That hadn't actually crossed my mind. Beth turned from the window and scowled at Jay, crossing her arms. "Nor mine, really." Jay looked up, offering an apologetic smile. "So where does that leave us?" Through the floor came the dull sound of television. From the flat above came gentle sobbing. The street outside was as still and free of foreboding as any perfect Sunday morning. No cars. No people. No sound. Silence. Perhaps resigned silence. Pensive and reflective. Or perhaps unaware, blissful and unknowing. The silence of those still asleep enjoying the lion. Or lost in recovery of a hangover. Jay sighed. "I could really do with a cigarette." "A bit late for that now. Unless you kept a secret stash from before we met. Or, you know, you took up smoking again on the sly. You'll never get any in time." "Well, there is a stash of sorts. But not from the land that time forgot." Beth raised an eyebrow. "And nothing behind your back. Remember when Yuri stayed with us a few weeks back?" "Yeah, smoked like a chimney. Terrace row of chimneys." "Yeah, he left a packet behind, half a packet. I put it away for, well, I don't know what, but I guess the end of the world is as good an excuse as any to light up. It's not like I'll be able to get the habit again. Won't even finish the first one." Jay got up and went to the kitchen. Never doing today what could be put off until tomorrow, had filled the small space with Jenga towers of recycling, washing up, and last night's debris. Two pizza boxes. His and hers not quite finished wine bottles, and the lingering air of the row that had stormed from kitchen to living room and into sleep. Nothing that would ever be cleared up now. He rummaged at the back of the odds and ends drawer. Returning with a pack of cigarettes and a box of matches, Jay's lips pulled the stale cigarette from the pack as the tick-fizz hush of a match brought to life lit the silence. In the still air of the living room, Reflex called Habit out of retirement to cup his hands around the newborn flame as if he and he alone could shield it from the coming storm. Jay lit up and took a drag that went deeper than all the troubles the world and its end could ever reach. He held it a moment, breathing out, his eyes closed, his shoulders sloped to calm, his body loosened. Beth watched the release, entranced by this unfamiliar ripple through a body whose movements she knew so well. She reached across and drew a cigarette from the packet. As Jay raised an eyebrow, she lit up. The breath she took came back at once, convulsing her, eyes wide. I'm guessing that's your first time. Beth coughed and laughed and coughed again. You guess right. Not something I've ever wanted to try. Not at school, not at uni, not at the office party. But we're here. Just you and me. At the end, I wanted to share something. I thought no harm in trying. Nothing to lose. You know, how hard could it be? She coughed. Harder than I thought. And less pleasant. Not sure I want to try that again. She smiled. But at least we both have cigarette breath. She leant over towards Jay. Jay pulled back a moment, took another drag, then drew Beth to him, looking in her eyes as he parted her lips with his, breathing into her slowly as she drew on him. When their lips drew back, she breathed out to one side, pausing a moment, but not coughing. Again, she said. They had all the time in the world, all those moments, moments in countdown. Another drag, shared and released. Then another kiss, this time smokeless and slow. A kiss from memory, the silent explorations of two new lovers. Few moments were left between them. Her cigarette fell. Reflex moved her hand to rescue it in the carpet. With a smile, Jay dropped his cigarette next to hers. Mañana, mañana, he whispered. She laughed and whispered back, ashes to ashes. One last moment. It was one last moment. They closed their eyes. They embraced. They kissed. And then they were gone.
Well, thank you very much, Kevin. I'll have a quick 5 minutes for people to order new drinks, and then we'll have Joe.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.